Hi, everyone. Good evening. Welcome to Evoke Therapy Program's broadcast. Today is Monday, August 9th, 2021. Getting ahead of myself. Tonight's structure of the broadcast, if you're new to it, is to submit questions at any time. We take any questions that are left over from the last broadcast or that are sent in to us throughout the week via our email address at webinar@evoketherapy.com. So we'll take any live questions, any topics that you have for us this evening. Becky, who is moderating for me this evening, will pass those on to me when there's space. She'll pass those on to me anonymously. So feel free to submit any questions or topics at any time. And let me get right to the one pre-submitted question from the week. Somebody writes, my son is some years out of intense therapy. He seems like he is all talk and no action still. Do we let it go? He is 25, or do we encourage him to reconnect with his therapist or therapy center from 2 years ago? I know it's a lot to ask without more background. Thanks. Generally speaking, I don't encourage any kind of strong push toward outpatient therapy. Outpatient therapy works really well if you're motivated, you know, if you have a strong desire. I think family therapy can work if you have moderate levels of motivation, but individual therapy or reaching out, I don't have the inclination to push, to offer it as a support, but I imagine he probably already knows that you would support it. You know, to offer it can be okay if he doesn't know, but for the most part, I don't think it helps really to kind of push or pressure or even strongly suggest that somebody reach out. You know, to the early part of your question, he seems to be all talk and no action still. My question is, why all talk and no action? You know, what's he getting out of that behavior? See, what therapy does for us, what it does for me, and what it does for me as a father is this is really important. It helps me to understand what the purpose of the behavior is. Instead of thinking about something in terms of right or wrong behaviors, good or bad behaviors, even healthy or unhealthy behaviors, my question is, what is motivating this behavior? So maybe his all talk and no action is that he's trying to present an image that you can buy, that you can find acceptable, that you won't grow impatient with, that you won't grow frustrated or exhausted by. And in that sense, in that very strange sense, you're contributing to the issue that you see as the problem, if that makes sense. In other words, he's finding you to not be a safe person to be able to tell the truth about what's really going on for him. That's the no action, right? He's trying to present an image, an idea, a facade that you will find acceptable and rather than something that is unacceptable. So I'd be more curious about why he's presenting. And I in general, no. Even with adolescents, I'm reluctant to require individual therapy, although I'm more open to it. I'm reluctant to require individual therapy because outpatient therapy is so impacted by the motivation of the client. I'm a client in therapy. I've been a client in therapy on and off for 30 years, 22 years with my current therapist. And it takes a lot of work. You know, if it didn't take a lot of work, I would have been done with it 15 or 20 years ago. But it takes a lot of work to make progress and to find yourself and to tell the truth about yourself and the world. So in general, my answer to the question is no. I also respect that you say, you know, it's a lot to ask without more background. And that should always be my qualifier when I answer these questions is I don't know all of the context, all of the variables involved. But in general, no. Let him know that it's available. If he doesn't, I suspect that he knows that it is. Get curious about the behavior instead of thinking about it as right or wrong behavior. And then, you know, make sure you're doing your own work. I mean, I know that I say that virtually in response to every question and every broadcast that I do, but make sure that you're doing your own work so that you're not getting involved in something that's not your business. Now, if his no action is starting to impact your life, your boundaries, or your home, you can set boundaries around that, right? That's perfectly, not only is it okay, But that's your responsibility. And Al-Anon, they talk about this idea of, keep your side of the street clean. And the Serenity Prayer, they say, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, and the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. It's not our job to push our children, our spouses, our brothers, our sisters, our parents. It's not our job to push them in the direction that we think they need to go, but rather to support them in their journey, and then to make sure, principally, that we're taking care of ourselves, that our boundaries are clear, that that our sense of self, well-being, our truth, our needs, our preferences, our tolerances, that those are respected. And that's where I think it can come into play. So yeah, that's a great question. It's a fantastic question. And one that I think I don't know that I've made a complete 180 on over the last 20 or so years, but I've definitely moved away from encouraging parents to push children into individual therapy. Family therapy, more so, because family therapy can be something where you're working on you, where you're working on what do I need to do? What's my contribution to the pattern or to the cycle? So thank you for that. The next question that comes in is, what is a typical day like? Well, funny you should ask, because I happen to have a slide from this very presentation. It's camping therapy. Primitive living, which means that everything is on your back that you need to live. The food is separated. Your shelter is something you make every day. You're carrying some part of your laundry, your personal food, a portion of the group food, your water, of course, your sleeping bag, the different layers that you'll need for the weather. So there's making fire, making breakfast, cooking lunch, hiking. We hope for hiking 4 or 5 days a week, 2 days where they're laying over, which means that they're getting resupply and the therapist is visiting. There's days for showers, but it's really just about camping and moving from site to site. Our model is primitive living nomadic, which means we're not going to cabins, we're not going to a base camp. And it's nomadic, which means that we're hiking from location to location. And then everything becomes grist for the mill, right? That small group living becomes a microcosm for the family. So even if you didn't tell us about your child's issues, problem solving, frustration tolerance, right? Coping mechanisms, communication styles, even if you didn't give us an application with that information, it would be exposed in the process. And that's another thing. That's another reason, going back to the last question about why wilderness therapy can work, where outpatient therapy might not, is that wilderness therapy doesn't let you hide. Your issues eventually come to the surface because you can't escape the group that you're in. You can't escape the relationships you're in, the tasks that you have to share, like cleaning up and getting ready and making fire and cleaning up the fire at the end of the day and so forth and so on. So it's there's group therapy, there's group discussions, there's standing groups, which are short groups that happen all day long. There's emotional curriculum, which means assignments from the therapist. There's also academic curriculum. There are chores. There are all these shared responsibilities, and they rotate. And all of those just become the grist for the mill. Even games. We want to have what we call, kind of tongue in cheek, mandatory fun time, because sometimes some students want to stay out of it, so we try to come up with games and activities to suggest to them that you can have fun in the simplest and purest of ways. You can connect to people on a really simple, beautiful, sitting around the campfire kind of way. We have group readings at night. We have music. We have storytelling. We have that kind of thing. But it's just camping, small groups, nomadic, moving from place to place, primitive to living, so we're not going indoors for the entire 8 to 12 weeks. And then everything becomes therapy. There's the therapy session and the treatment plan that happens Tuesday, 2 days a week when the therapist is there. But really, the powerful stuff that happens in wilderness is the stuff that happens in between. I'll tell you two stories to illustrate this. I remember my first few months as a wilderness therapist, and I missed a week. And back then, we didn't have therapists that would replace us while we were gone. Just the staff managed the group, and the parents went without a phone call for a week. And I remember coming back and I asked Joe, who now is still a friend of mine and is on our intensives team. And I came back and I said, how was it, Joe? Expecting maybe there was some difficulty and some lag and some slowing down. He said, it was the best week I've seen this group have in a long time. And of course it was humbling to me because I thought I was the magic of it. And I realized that it's the stuff that happens in between therapy that's the real work. I think it was Claude Debussy that said that music is not the notes, but the space in between the notes that makes it music. And I think in a lot of ways, therapy isn't the therapy session, but it's the time and the space in between the therapy sessions that is the therapy. And so it's that 5 days in between where the lessons get learned, the lessons get tried, the lessons get their opportunity to see if they can take root in the individual's life. So that's really what wilderness therapy is about. The other story I'll tell you is we had a therapist and he worked with us for many years. And then he went to work at a residential treatment center, and then he came back. And when he was coming back, he offered his families to finish up his students back in the wilderness for a month or so, because they weren't quite done. He didn't want to leave them, and wilderness would be a nice, interesting way to kind of finish their work. And so a couple of his boys came with him back into wilderness when he came back to work for us. And I remember he was sitting in clinical meeting explaining this to the other therapist. He was saying, you know, I walked into the session with my boy, the boy that I work with, and he started to put up the same old walls, you know, the same old pushback in therapy. And so David was the therapist's name. David said, so after a few minutes, I just said, you know what? It's okay. If you don't want to have a session, I don't need to do this. And he started to walk away. And his client, his student said, no, don't leave. Don't leave, please. I'll talk. And he said, I was reminded of the power of wilderness therapy. You know, that time where you leave, you drive your car away from the group and you're not going to be back for 5 days. That's a moment. And it compels the wilderness client, the wilderness student, to really take advantage of it. Whereas if you're working in a residential treatment center, you'll be back tomorrow. They can push you away for a day or two, but you'll be back Monday through Friday the next day. So wilderness therapy is this place that I think for both parents and for our students really provokes the work, really evokes the work more than just outpatient therapy or residential therapy. It's powerful, dynamic stuff. I've never seen anything more impactful. So that's what a typical day is like. Looks like there are no other questions right now. There's several of you on, but I don't have any questions. I'll wait for a moment to see if there are any questions or topics you'd like me to speak about. Somebody writes, how are parent letters used as part of the therapy? I think that letter writing therapy is one of the most powerful but underestimated parts of the work. You know, first of all, letter writing is a lost practice or art, as they say. And most of the time, our communications are electronic and immediate. And while we don't use snail mail, right, the postal service like we did in the early days of wilderness therapy, some people had fax machines, if you remember, mailboxes, et cetera, or the UPS store later on that you would go to and you would use that as a fax. Or if you had a fax machine at work, or some people had fax machines at home, that took some time. So you could sit there, you could write, you could be deliberate. When I get a letter from a parent or from a student, and I read it with the parent or I read it with the student, we can really look at it as, on paper, as something very intentional. If you and I were just talking, or I would just if I was facilitating a family therapy session between you and your child and you were talking, I might pause you and ask you about that. But because your thoughts and your words aren't always connected, you'll say, well, that's not what I meant. Or maybe I said that, but that wasn't my intention. On paper, we can really be deliberate. And because you have to wait 2 or 3 days for a response, they have to wait 4 or 5 days for a response, I think you learn to speak from your truth a little bit more. So how we use them, we guide you with a couple of them with very specific assignments and objectives. Beyond that, we give you general coaching, maybe some not to do's or some to do's. And then we don't want to overcoach it to you. We don't want you to have to always write the perfect letter. We'll give you some basic guidelines and outlines, but we want them to deal in part with the real you. Now, when they send letters back out, I think one of the thoughts that both students and parents have is that we really do coach that. And I discourage overcoaching letters that are coming from your child to you. In fact, sometimes if I sit with a child, which I often do, and read their letters coming out to you, and I have some feedback or some questions about it, or they even ask me for my opinion and I give it, they want to rewrite it. And I say, please don't rewrite it. Please don't rewrite it. Send it out to your parents and write a new one if you want to, so they can see what you're learning. And some children will say, when they write a really horrible, angry letter, like, oh, you're gonna edit this. And my response to the child is, why would I edit a horrible letter to your parents? I want them to see where you're at. Why do I not want them to see where you're at? I want them to have that experience. Another one last idea about letter writing is, if you write a letter or are thinking about writing a letter or have a kind of an impulse to write a certain thing in a letter, and through the phone call with the therapist, we do some coaching and you change your perspective, or you don't want to respond with your old triggers, I think one way you can accomplish authenticity and using new skills is to say, here's my initial reaction, or here's how I wanted to react, or here's how I used to react to it. Now I'm learning to react this way. I wanted to tell you were wrong. I wanted to debate. I wanted to get defensive. But now I'm learning to listen. Now I'm learning to hear you. Now I want to hear what you have to say. I'm learning to manage my triggers. So it's a very slowed down, deliberate family therapy session. Sometimes they're the focus of the session. Sometimes they're not in the session. It really depends upon where they're at, what's going on for the week. Was there specific objectives or goals for the letters coming in or going out? But it is, we definitely want to incorporate them. I often will start the phone calls with you saying, did you read the letter this week? Did you have reactions? We want to hear your natural reactions before we go through the coaching. Right? Are you feeling discouraged? Do you want to give up? Are you feeling angry or hurt or confused, triggered? And then we'll give you a perspective on what was going on during the week. So just think about the opportunity to kind of have a family therapy session and slow it down and put it on paper so that we can really create an intentional exchange of communication, ideas, thoughts, and feelings. That's how we use them. Somebody writes, I need to hear repeatedly about letting go and staying on my side of the fence. Can you talk more and give your great examples? Thank you. Well, I don't know if I can give you my great examples, but I can give you a couple of examples. You know, whenever you're thinking about your child's progress or lack thereof, I would just encourage you to focus on your progress or lack thereof. When you think about your child's relapse prevention plan, focus on your relapse prevention plan. It's the difference between hitting a tennis ball and trusting your swing and trying to aim it. It's the difference between trying to convince somebody to think and feel a certain way versus telling the truth. My favorite example of letting go is telling the truth. Telling the truth is the ultimate but simple example of letting go. The reason we lie or don't tell the truth often is because we're trying to manage what somebody thinks, feels, or how they perceive us. And when we learn to tell the truth from a place of authenticity and clarity and ideally love, and then we give the person the right, the privilege to feel and think what they want to feel and think. It's the shift from thinking that boundaries are about changing your behavior, the other person's behavior, versus boundaries are changing and taking care of myself. And so here's what's amazing about letting go and then staying on your side of the street or your side of the fence. In the serenity prayer, which I referenced earlier, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. That prayer, or I call it a meditation sometimes, that prayer or meditation is said in practice. It's a tradition for it to be said at the end of every 12-step support group. Not all of them do this, but most or many do. What I laugh about with it is we are so easy to forget the difference between what I can control and what I can't control, which is pretty simple. I can't control you, but I can control me. That we have to pray at the end to have the wisdom to know the difference. Isn't that amazing? That's how easily we get confused by it. That if we attend 12-step meetings once or twice or three times a week for 50 years, we're going to be saying that prayer at the end every time. So you're in good company if you lose track of what it means to stay on your side of the street. My practice, and it's a practice, is to remember on a daily basis that I can't control my children. I work hard to try to control myself, to try to monitor, engage my own reactions, be responsible and accountable for my own reactions and triggers. But I can't control them. And in operating from an awareness of those principles, I actually have a wonderful, wonderful impact on others. When I teach this to our therapists, they'll say, but Brad, we are hired to facilitate change in other people. And I say to them, I know you are. This is how you do it. You don't confront the defense. You don't grab it by the lapels and shove it into a corner. You understand. It's so ironic. It's what Taoism teaches, right? It's what radical acceptance in Buddhism teaches. It's what faith and the Judeo-Christian traditions are speaking about. You let go, but you become more powerful of a leader. That's what George Lucas was talking about when he was teaching Joseph Campbell's philosophy in Star Wars. The Force is a way of being with people where you have greater influence, but you're not controlling them like the way that Darth Vader was. All of these philosophies combine this idea of letting go, but becoming more influential and more impactful. So I'm glad that you need to be reminded of it, because that means you're not alone, that you're a very, very typical person. Next question. Somebody writes, as my child is progressing through As my child is progressing through his post-evoke residential placement and earning privileges, there are signs and symptoms resurfacing. It's such a tricky thing to decide if coming home without patient supports is the next step or another residential academic setting. I don't really have a question, as I know there's no right answer, but it feels like we'll be making the best guess about how much and what type of supports are needed. I've never seen sustained success in a real world setting, but I don't want the past to box in his future. I mean, from your question, it sounds like you kind of know the answer. My therapist said something to me years ago when I wrote about this in my first book when my wife and I were separated in 2010. She said to me, you know, if you get divorced, your life will be different. I was asking, not for her advice, but just telling her the dilemma. And she said, just like if you change from being a therapist to you go back to school and become an engineer, your life will be different. It's kind of like there's no right answer. You don't get to choose how to win. You don't get to win. You get to choose how to lose. So the question you're asking is the right question. It's, you know, when my son, my oldest, who's now 28, when he was 13 and he went to wilderness, he turned 14 in the wilderness, and then he went to a therapeutic boarding school for some time after. And I was getting closer to my readiness for him coming home. I will tell you, the therapist and the consultant were telling me he wasn't ready. And I said to them, I don't think that's the right argument because I'm ready. Parents don't like to say that sometimes because they don't want to be responsible for when the child comes home in a way. They want the child to objectively achieve some level of functioning and consistency, some level of internalized principles, ideas, and behaviors that the child is fully cooked. Now, my son was 14, so I didn't think we were going to keep him in forever. And he wasn't ready, but I was ready. And it wasn't smooth after Avoca. We had some significant difficulties. And it wasn't until really around the age of 17 that he turned it all around. He's been sober since then. He now has a master's degree in organizational psychology. He's one of the funniest. He does stand-up comedy. He's a gifted artist. And he works in graphic design. He can paint, sculpt, play two or three instruments at various levels. You know, has a wonderful social life, lives a meaningful life. And 14 to 17 wasn't smooth or easy. And there was a moment before he got sober. And by the way, drugs and alcohol weren't his primary issue when we sent him to wilderness in the first place. But like a lot of these children who were struggling with emotions, it was a great escape for him. And there was some days prior to his sobriety where I had literally, not figuratively, literally the phone number in my back pocket of a friend who ran a program that I would had already talked to. And a space was cleared for my son. But I kept talking and kept listening. I didn't focus on good and bad behaviors, but rather on being a safe person for him to talk to. And I would have pulled the trigger. I was weeks, if not days, away from pulling the trigger. But the communication kept getting better and better. And he turned it around. It wouldn't have been a failure if I had sent him, if I had sent him. That would have been okay too. So, yeah, listen to his progress, see what he's learning. And when you're ready for the challenges that are going to be there, you're ready. And if he gets mad at you and says, well, this is about you being ready, your response can be, I'm working on it as fast as I can. I'm doing as the best I can to be as ready as possible. And that's the reality of it. He'll come home, unless he's 18 and he walks away. He'll come home or finish the program when you're ready. And that for me is, it's been a helpful way to think about the shift in this. When I'm talking to a parent and they're considering coming home or aftercare or whatever, I want to find out how they're thinking. That's really what these podcasts, broadcasts, what my books are about. It's not about what you're doing, it's why you're doing it. And if you're doing it because there's some kind of guarantee of success, I think that speaks more to control. If you're doing it with the acceptance of the reality that you have no control over him or her or them, but that you're ready to try it. And I always say to parents, I do this thought experiment. I did it today with somebody. How do you know? How will you know 2 years from now if you've made the right decision? I ask this in parenting support groups. You can answer this question yourself. How will you know if you made the right decision 2 years from now? And I wait for people, and usually people will say, well, you know, they're doing well. You know, we haven't had major setbacks. They're still, they come up with outcome answers. And what I say is, you'll know you made the right decision because it was your decision. And if it goes well, fantastic. And if it doesn't go well, fantastic. Because isn't that the way life is? You know, we make choices and then we deal with it. We deal with what comes of it. So maybe the thing I'm telling you that's a little bit different tonight is it's when you're ready and it'll be different. And just keep your eyes open and watch. And know that mistakes for all of you are a part of the process. It's not about getting to a level of pristine behavior, right? It's really about a deeper, richer process and awareness on your part, and being able to figure out how to be with them, to not participate in the problem, the dynamic that's become a problem, and how to support them where they need to go. And I don't want to ever forget this. And knowing that you have boundaries and it's okay wherever they are, wherever you need them to be. It's too big of a choice for somebody else to dictate to you. Because if you don't trust your instinct, you're going to regret it. If you defer too much, you're going to regret it. If you don't allow yourself to be challenged, to challenge your instincts, you're going to miss opportunities. And where that line is, there's only one person on planet Earth that can answer, and that's you. You get to decide, and it's not easy. Thank you for that. Somebody writes this. Can you speak more specifically about what a child needs to achieve in order to get to water phase? I listened to the webinar, but I did not hear what was necessary to move to this phase. It's really about moving from internal locus of control, excuse me, external locus of control motivated by externals, to starting to taste the sweetness of it, to starting to feel the intrinsic kind of value of the change, right? That's that second phase, fire phase, is about accountability, cooperation, right? Working with the program, trying it. You know, children go from you know, rejecting the process, to resigning themselves to the process, to accepting the process, to investing. And it's somewhere between the accepting and investing. I love when I get to see a student say, I feel better. Doesn't mean that it has legs and that it'll never go away and they'll never lose motivation. But when they get a taste of what it's like to be their authentic selves, to own their emotions, to know what's operating inside of their head, to have some sense of where their defenses and their wounds are, and that exploration is worthy of attention. It's the change from, I'm doing it because it kind of works out better for me pragmatically, to I'm doing it because it feels better. It reminds me of a saying that somebody told me about, I heard somebody say years ago about sobriety. People start using substances for the same reason they stop, because it feels better, because they feel better. And I think that's the transition. Now there are objective assignments to complete in each of the phases, but those are the principles. And while we use those assignments as markers, as indicators, it's not all about that. Those are just tools that are reference points. And the phases are fluid back and forth too, because you can regress. And regression isn't bad. Regression is regression. Everybody experiences regression. Just go back to a family reunion or go back to your mother and father, and you'll be hit squarely between the eyes at what regression feels like on a personal level. Hang out with your siblings. Go to your 30 year or whatever year it is, go to your 30 year high school reunion, and you can write a dissertation on regression. Because old context, old situations, old triggers, push us back into primitive old ways of reacting to things. Somebody writes, my daughter has just started the Entrada program early last week. I can rationalize the decision that was made without her, but the guilt for forcing this process upon her is quite a struggle. Thoughts? My first thought is just love and support. Guilt is a monster. And welcome to the family, by the way, but as you listen to the webinars I've done, the broadcasts or podcasts I've done on guilt and shame, the two books that I've written talk a lot about guilt and shame, I think. See, we were told that shame, we've been told lately that shame is feeling bad about who you are and that guilt is feeling bad for what you do. I don't think that's really important. You're going to feel guilty if you do the right thing. Lots of times. Guilt is not an indication of right or wrong. Guilt is a conditioning that we receive from childhood that we're supposed to feel bad when we upset our mom and dad or our teachers or our authority figures, our grandparents, our siblings, our surroundings. Guilt is no more than our belief that we've hurt or upset somebody or our anticipation that we might hurt somebody. If we are to grow morally, if we are to grow in authenticity, we will have to learn to tolerate guilt. My favorite book, even better than what I just said to read, Harriet Lerner's book, The Dance of Anger. And I did a podcast on it. It's one of our 5 most listened to podcasts. Read The Dance of Anger or listen to the podcast or do both. She says in there, one of my favorite quotes is she said, guilt is only an effective tool. She says, anger is only an effective tool if it causes us to be clear about ourselves. But she says, we have to learn to feel guilt in order to do the right thing. So the work that you have to do to let go of guilt is gonna lead you to not tell the truth in your relationships. It's gonna lead you to not have healthy boundaries. It's gonna lead you to not stand up for yourself, to say no. Guilt is just as toxic as shame. I think it's more insidious than shame because I've had, about 10 years ago, I said to my therapist, look, I'm done arguing about the virtues of guilt. I'm just done debating it. Because everybody listening to my voice, live or on the podcast, can immediately come up with an example where doing the right thing would cause them to feel guilty. Just think about that. Everybody can think of an example immediately, a real example in their life where doing the right thing would cause you to feel guilty. And if guilt can tell you to do the wrong thing, if you can feel guilt when you're doing the right thing, it is not a reliable North Star of morality, of good choices. So the work is to let go of guilt and to unravel it and to figure out what's going on there and where it came from and how nonsensical it is. I remember I was teaching this in church in another lifetime. Didn't go over so well in church. They were big fans of guilt in the church that I was teaching it in, but I was teaching it, and one of the class members who was an attorney, he said at Stanford, because, you know, he mentioned that he went to Stanford, a nice guy, but he said at Stanford in law school, you know, we were one of our assignments was to go to a maximum security prison and interview inmates. And I had the opportunity, he said, to interview somebody who had shot somebody at a convenience store over $200. And I asked this gentleman, I said, what did you do after you shot the person? And the guy said, I just went home and went to bed. So this gentleman telling me this anecdotal story about his law school assignment said, so if not for guilt, Brad, then why would we do anything right? And I thought about it for a moment. I said, love, for starters. That twang of regret, of remorse, can wake us up. That twinge of guilt can cause us to ask a question. But just like the ignition on a car, if you still have a car that has an ignition switch, that this analogy is going to get old soon. It works to start the car, but if you keep cranking it, it won't work anymore. It could just be a spark, a beginning, but we should look at our guilt critically. And I will tell you that it's really important to kind of work through that as a parent, as a spouse, as a person, as a human being, because guilt lies to us every day. So it's really worth unraveling. Thank you for the question and welcome to the Evoke family. Somebody writes, could you please go over what process takes place from the point a child leaves Evoke and goes to a therapeutic boarding school? Ideally, it's as seamless as possible. Not extra time, not extra downtime, no phone calls. It's the most vulnerable time. Now, we do have an option that we didn't have for years, which we have a pursuits program, which is separate from our wellness program. So if you want to spend extra days, you can talk to our pursuits team. In fact, I'll just pull up this slide while I'm talking. Contact Sarah, S-A-R-A, at evoketherapy.com. Some folks on here have used a pursuits program in between because it gives you extra time with staff support, 2, 3, 4, 5 days, customized wilderness therapy, adventure activities, camping, horseback riding, whatever you want, however you want to design it, with support, with a backstop, with a safety net. But it's just a vulnerable time. And I would just encourage you, I've done it. I've transferred a child of mine from wilderness to a therapeutic boarding school. It's painful. And all those added extras that you think about, all those things that you think you can do, all of those things become really an emotional trial for the child. I even have one student that I'm still in contact with often who graduated at the highest level and had earned, he thought, and his parents thought, a little bit of extra downtime, a couple of extra days in a hotel, maybe a couple of movies. And I met with him during the transition. He said, Brad, this isn't working for me. They allowed me to talk to my girlfriend, which we had cleared, and I want to go home now. I talked to my brother, and I want to go home now. So seamlessness is important, and it gets hard. It's not easy. When I was in woodshop as a in middle school, and the only thing I was good at making was a breadboard. I never got past making a breadboard where you just glue a bunch of different color kinds of wood together and you put them in a vise with glue in between. And I remember our teacher, to demonstrate, glued a couple together and he took them and he broke them over his knee. And he showed us that one broke where they were glued together, right along the glue seam. And one broke and kind of shattered across the seams. And he was demonstrating that if you don't do it well, the seam is the most vulnerable part, that in between. Do the visit after, or do it with support with a pursuits trip. Let him or her or them get settled and then do the visit, the extra time where you have support. It's a trying time. So seamlessness is the key. Any other questions, Becky? No other questions? I can begin to wrap up. If there's one more question, I can take it at the end. My two books, which I, of course, strongly recommend, The Journey of the Heroic Parent and The Audacity to Be You, are available on Amazon and Audible. I read the audiobook for The Audacity to Be You. If you want to do a deep dive into your own, if you want to do a deep dive into your own work, we have intensives for individuals. These are 4.5-day programs in person or online. These are 2.5-day programs that can kind of get you into the work, can springboard you into it, or can accelerate your work. It's looking at your family of origin, your past, and how it's showing up today. Returning to You, we have one October 6th through 10th that I'll be co-leading with our clinical director, Travis Slagle, and that is anybody who's attended Finding You previously. just contact intensives at evoketherapy.com for more information. We have support groups for current and alumni families. Our next one is August 12th at 6:30 p.m. Mountain Time. And we have intensive alumni meetings online for our intensive folks. That's tomorrow night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time. Email Malia at evoketherapy.com for more information. We have, this is something we're doing new this last year. We have coaching. So therapists who have been wilderness therapists or intensive therapists are offering virtual coaching, virtual therapy online. So if you're interested in continuing the work beyond wilderness therapy or aside from wilderness therapy or beyond your intensive work with someone who knows what it's like, contact Travis at evoketherapy.com. We ask all current parents to attend 6 12-step support groups, any combination of Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, AdultChildren.org, RefugeRecovery.org, or NAMI.org. You can also go there for classes and information in your local area. All of these broadcasts are available on any of your podcast streaming apps, including Spotify. Just go to a podcast app and search Finding You at Evoke Therapy Podcast, or you can just go to SoundCloud.com and search Finding You at Evoke Therapy Podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Evoke Therapy using the handle at Evoke Therapy, or on, you can find at Evoke Therapy Intensives on Instagram. Also, my handle is at Dr. Brad Reedy, and that's at DrBradReedy. You can find us on Facebook by searching Evoke Therapy Programs or Evoke Therapy Intensives. And then we also have a blog that's wonderfully curated by Malia. My next broadcast will be August 18th. That's, we'll be talking about wilderness in the summer, what it's like in the summertime. And as the summer ends and you get ready to go back to school, we'll be talking about that. Every other time, of course, we have Q&As. It looks like maybe one other question has come in. All right, I'll finish up with this one. My 16-year-old wrote in his letter that he felt sad, angry, and terrified about going to a therapeutic boarding school. Can you speak to what, if anything, changes with therapy, both group and individual, going forward? I'm interested in what takes place in the last month in after once a child finds out they won't be going home. Evoke is time spent moving the child from resistance, acceptance, and to buy-in. What percent of kids get it to acceptance or even to buy-in? Yes, it's moving them along for sure. One critical contribution you can make to their buy-in, this will sound strange, but don't try to get them to buy in. Think Mr. Rogers. I'm a huge fan of now of Mr. Rogers. When I was a little kid, I thought he was weird and creepy or patronizing, probably because I was an adultified child. But now I realize he was a genius. Now I aspire to be more like him without the cardigan, of course, and to realize that you sit and you listen to people and that allowing people to speak their truth, their unmentionable truth, and you listen to it with empathy and patience and love, that people heal. See, that's the thing that therapy has taught me as a father and a man and a husband, is that if you can listen to people, truly listen and see them, that they heal. But then when we attempt to try to fix them or move them along in the way that we think that they need to be moved along, that they feel not seen and not heard. So I don't know if your son or daughter, son I think it is, will be one of the ones that gets to buy in. Most of our clients do. But your job in that task is to not to try to get them to buy in, to let go, to listen, to understand, to empathize. It's a very normal feeling. I remember one time years ago, the design of the program was a little bit different. We had a graduation camp and I pulled up to it and grandma and grandpa came up to me because mom and dad weren't involved. One was passed away, one was in jail. But anyway, I pulled up and grandma met me at the road and she said, "We have a problem." And I said, "That's what I'm here for. What is it?" She said, "It's just not going well." I said, "Well, let's get right to it." So we walked over, we sat down and exchanged pleasantries and opening thoughts. And the young, their grandson was cooking their dinner. And I said, "So give me a story about what's going on." And grandma and grandpa said, well, he told me that he's really upset and scared to go to the next school. I said, okay, keep going. They said, that's it. And I could see my client, my student, had a smile on his face. And I said, was he trying to talk you out of it? And they said, well, I don't think so, not really. I said, was he asking for something? And they said, well, maybe it was implied, but not overtly. And I said, I don't understand what's broken. Wouldn't you be scared if you were leaving something comfortable? I remember that night I had the first thought that leaving wilderness is like leaving home again. It's what you become comfortable with and is predictable and is the known. And that's the heroic journey, right? Is to go to the unknown, to walk into the forest or to the cave that you fear to enter, right? To go into that new place, to walk into that. If you decide to follow our directives and walk into one of these meetings that I've listed here, Al-Anon, CODA, Families Anonymous, or Adult Children, or Refuge Recovery, that's what it will feel like to you. Only for him, it's a much more immersive and larger process. And so let him feel it. It's okay. Just listen, understand, and empathize. Isn't that one of the hardest things as a parent, is to hold space empathically for our children when we could prevent the uncomfortable feeling from occurring by changing or capitulating? And yet we remain committed to the course because we know that's what just recently with my daughter, there was a natural consequence that I was one of two people in charge of kind of following through on. And my daughter said to me, I don't think you know how this is going to affect me. She was very upset. And I said, I think I might have a sense of how it's going to affect you, but it's not going to change my decision. I didn't say that out loud, but I just said, I get it. I'm sorry. But I wasn't going to change because it was going to be hard and painful. And I don't say that like I do that every day and I've done that my whole life. That was like 25 years of therapy led to that moment. So having the capacity to let a child feel the distress and staying committed to our boundary, our truth, is a powerful, powerful, powerful thing to do. So, yeah. Thanks for that. I'll take one more if there's another one. Is the online finding you very effective versus in person? It's more effective than I thought it would ever be. I think it's a great option. It's half of the finding you in person. I just want to make it clear. Finding you part one online is family of origin. Finding you part two online is current day. Finding you in person is both. So it's half the time, much less than half the cost. So I think it's a great option if time and money, which it is for many of us, are pieces of the equation. I was skeptical of it. We started it during the pandemic for obvious reasons. And I said at the beginning, I don't think we can do this online. And I've been blown away with the impact of it. So yes, it's effective. If you have the time and the money and the resources, finding you in person, I think is the downtime is the richer part. It's all the times in between, right? It's dinner, it's breakfast, it's the walks that you go on together. We try to replicate that by having the Zoom meeting be on all the time so you can eat together. But the in-person stuff, there's something visceral about being in person. I like the one online better as a therapist in some ways because I take lots of notes when I'm doing it online out of your view. But when I'm sitting with you in person, I have to track it all in my head, and I it's a little bit harder to track. So there's a little bit that I like as an advantage to the online one, but they're different. Back to what my therapist said earlier in the broadcast in another example, it's different, and it's worth it, and I believe in them. And it's I think I've said this before. The intensives are the thing that I can sell the easy. I don't consider myself a salesperson, but I do these myself. My wife, my adult children have done these themselves. Our therapists, my business partners have done them. I've sent friends to these. I believe in intensives as a part of a self-help, of a growth process, of a therapeutic process. One more question. Can I talk about the value of benefit of individual versus group therapy? Individual therapy is easier as a therapist because I can hold space for one person, and in group, I have to kind of make sure everybody else is being safe. But group therapy, there's something about a peer giving you feedback or observations that can be helpful, right? There's times when it benefits to have somebody who's not an authority figure give you their perspective. The other thing is, if you have an adequate therapist, is they're also not qualified to give the same quality of feedback and experience and holding for you. Sometimes peers can easily dip into advice and being the expert, and hopefully a good therapist won't do that, or if they do, they'll apologize. So I think I think group therapy can be something that people can be more open to, but it also has risks because they're not professionally trained people. And I think the individual therapist, but I think you have to deal them with real relationships. So it's just different. And I always pay attention, we always pay attention in wilderness therapy to what works best. One of the things that the intensives that I love about it is that you learn as much by watching somebody else do their work as you do from your own. And I bet the people that have attended this would attest to that, that they have learned or did learn just as much from watching somebody else's work as they did from doing their own. I've seen it over and over and over again. I can attest to that. Some of the greatest lessons I've ever learned in my attendance as a participant in an intensive program is that I've gotten something out of somebody else's work about my work. By the time I even did my very first intensive and I got to my part, I already had it figured out from watching the three people that went before me. I got it because the dilemma was different in some ways, but it was the same. And I realized that my core task in my life is to show up and tell the truth about who I am and what I feel and what I need. That's my great weakness. I'm pretty good at holding space for people. That's both my wound and my gift, right? From being a codependent person. What I'm not as practiced at, what goes against my grain is showing up, telling the truth, holding a boundary, saying no, saying I can't, saying I'm not willing, letting people that I love hurt and suffer because I can't make it better, all of those things. So I learned by the time it was my turn that my job in my life will be to show up to my marriage, to my relationships, and try to tell the truth about who I am, what I feel, what I need, what I can't and can't do, what I am and am not willing to do. I know we have maybe a question or two left over, but we're wrapping up because it's the end of the hour. Thank you for your attendance this evening. For and on behalf of the people that love you, thank you for being willing to do your work. That's the only or the greatest gift that you can give to them. I hope these are helpful points of contact with you. I hope you also enjoy them on the podcast. Take care, folks. I'll talk to you next week. Have a good one. Bye-bye. Shadows slowly chose.